hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. We talked a little bit about my cardiac journey this year on I Don't Care, with beginning with my CT calcium scoring adventures that didn't go so well, and then my pretty emergent experience on the cath table, picking up 4 stents and doing great now. I mean, we're talking 7-8 months out now. It feel great. And, so I encourage everybody to have their CT calcium scoring test done. But so along those same lines, I've got one of my old buddies from cardiac days. Jorge Perotti is a cardiovascular leader, has done that at a number of different hospitals and health systems across the country. Jorge, welcome to I Don't Care.
Thank you, Kevin. Great to talk to you again. Great to see you, be part of your podcast.
Well, I appreciate you being on. So talk a little bit, share with my audience some about your history and how you got into cardiovascular services and what you've seen at your different stops along the way.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I got into cardiovascular services by accident way back in the early 2000s when people were starting to think and talk about service lines, about capturing one disease and then being able to align services around the patient instead of having the patient go through the maze of hospital departments. So much more patient-friendly and allows us to specialize a little bit more. And like I said, when I started back then, service lines were not very popular. They really didn't exist. And then it took about 5 years, I would say that probably in 2005 to 2010, to start taking off. And every program, every health system that offered cardiovascular services, oncology services, orthopedic services, starting a line within this service line model. And if you think about it, the patient can go through the service line cuts horizontally through all the vertical departments that take care of the patient. And I've seen that be very successful from a patient perspective. And now, 20, 25 years later, we see that a little bit more in flux. I think that the economics of healthcare sometimes do not allow for there be separate service line leadership as, cost goes up and reimbursement stagnates and cannot keep up with those costs.
Yeah. So let's talk about, health systems, hospitals and health systems throw the word center of excellence around a lot. What does that mean in the cardiovascular space? How do you position yourself as a center of excellence? And what does that really mean?
It means something different to everybody. I think to the Joint Commission, it means one thing. To the Blue Cross and different commercial payers, it means something different. To other public organizations that are reporting on quality and patient safety, it all means a little bit different. So, center of excellence in the broad definition is what services are you providing that support cardiac wellness, prevention, health? How well are you treating cardiovascular patients? What services do you offer? What technology do you make available? What treatment do you have? And if you check off enough marks, then you become a named cardiovascular center of excellence. Does it help you? It might give you a little preferential referrals within the commercial insurance world. It makes the Joint Commission happy, but it's also a differentiator or a competitive tool. If you say that you are the only cardiovascular center of excellence in your community, in your market, that might get you some more likes, some more patients coming to you for that care. But like everything else, everybody has the same badge and the same differentiator. It starts being a differentiator after all. And those are processes that times are expensive. You have to gather a lot of data, do a lot of data abstraction to try and meet the requirements and compare yourself against other centers in your region, across the country, nationally.
And you're talking about, on the national scale, there are a lot of different ways to be recognized. Obviously, people see the U.S. News and World Report rankings on an annual basis. But the American Heart Association has some recognitions as well, particularly around Get With The Guidelines. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The U.S. U.S. world and you know, business world and report that they're checking boxes, right? They're looking at things like, you know, what specialties do you have under your roof, staffing ratios, outcomes, you know, how well regarded you are. Do you offer a variety of progressively more invasive treatments up to and including, you know, heart transplantation? And then just, you know, count your tally and the top 10, top 20, top 25 are the ones that are named. If you look at that list, you'll see that's usually academic medical centers or very, very big systems that have deep pockets and are able to focus and specialize in these and that have a very, very, very well-renowned reputation. American Heart Association is a little bit different. It has to do more with outcomes and following guidelines and being able to implement guidelines that they sponsor and that they advocate for. So again, we're collecting a lot of quality data here, and we're looking at things that I think really matter to the patient. You know, how quickly did you get to the ER? How quickly did they do an EKG when you got to the ER? How quickly was that EKG read? And if you had to go to the cath lab, how quick did that happen? A lot of time span of different care. And then when you're done, what was the outcome? How long were you in the hospital for? Did you readmit? Do you have any complications? Do you cardiac rehab as a guideline? And, you know, a lot of patient education along the way. Did you get educated about your risk factors? Did you get educated about how to prevent, stay healthy, stay medications, lifestyle changes, et cetera? So, one is more patient focused and one is much more system focused to recognize systems that have made the investment and are performing at a national compared to national peers.
Let's kind of walk through the whole cardiovascular process. You know, I talked a little bit about the early detection preventative side, you know, and certainly, you know, focusing on CT calcium score. What are some of the other things? Okay, let's just put this scenario out there. I go to my primary care doc, you know, feel a little shortness of breath every now and then, you know, just overall tired, maybe some twinge pain, whatever. They run labs on that. And well, let's go back. What kind of labs would they run and what other preventative or diagnostic type tests could they do in the beginning of somebody's episode?
Yep. So you go to see your PCP, they make a referral to a cardiologist. The cardiologist sees you and they're going to do your regular blood pressure. They'll do an EKG on you right there in the clinic, in the office. And then if they want to further investigate, here's where you start peeling the layers of the onion back, right? You know what? We see something that we don't like. Let's go to get an echo or a stress echo, either exercise or pharmacological echo. And that can see how your heart is perfusing, how it's working. We still don't see that much there. Maybe we need to go and get a CT scan and see what your calcification is, see what kind of plaque do you have. And then if they see something potentially, okay, now we got to go and get a cath done, a diagnostic cath. And again, as you progress, it gets more and more invasive, right? So now they're actually putting a catheter in, you know, into your vasculature, going up to your heart to see what you have. You have ways now in the cath lab to see what the plaque is, what it looks like, if it's calcified or not. That's the thing. The technology has changed so much and there's so many new advances that it makes it so much easier. And then if they see something, they can measure. And they can assess how big a blockage is it. You know, how many blockages do you have? You know, you hit the foursome there, like you're telling people. And then there are different ways to intervene, to loosen the plaque up and get rid of it. Or are you going to need a stent? Are you going to need a drug-coated stent and a drug-coated balloon? And that's and if that doesn't do it, or if there's too much, there's too much happening there that just stenting and cleaning out won't do, then you go to the last step where they do will give a referral to a cardiovascular surgeon where surgery is being done. And it used to be the days when, you know, when we started this, a single vessel was a referral to surgery back in the early 2000s. And little by little, the technology got so much better that you can do it in the cath lab now. You can replace valves without having to go through surgery right now. And you know, how cardiac surgeons are, what they're doing is very different than what they were doing 20 years ago. And you know, along the way, we have had a lot of revolutionary technologies now, you know, being able to replace aortic valve with, you know, through wires, like guide wires, without having to cut somebody open. You can be gone in 24 hours instead of staying 2 weeks in a hospital recovering. And we're seeing that being done in the tricuspid space, and it's going to be done in the mitral space. That's a progression. And as we become more technology becomes available to be able to do this work in a less minimal, minimally invasive way, we're also seeing new diagnostic tools that can do things that could not be done 5 years ago. So the progression that I gave you there, where you get a CT that does not look very well, or you cannot tell what's plaque and how much, and have real good measurements, well, and you go to the cath lab, there's new technology out there right now being installed in the United States, where a CT scan has gotten so more precise and can see through calcium. Pretty soon, we're not going to need to do diagnostic caths anymore. It's all going to be done by general cardiologists that know how to read a CT scan, and a radiologist to overread. It's fascinating what we're seeing.
That's incredible. Yeah. You know, we were talking, back 20, 25 years ago. You're right. Yeah. I had a single heart surgeon in outstate Nebraska at my hospital. She did 250 open heart surgeries every year. I mean, she was crazy busy. You know, cath lab was kind of a new thing. They were just doing diagnostics and everybody's going straight to surgery. And now, like you said, things have shifted for the cardiac surgeon. You know, a lot of times now, they're the treatment of last resort. And so they've now found different ways to in which they work. You know, oftentimes they're there for backup in case, as you said, if somebody's having, a valve replaced, regardless of where, that cardiac surgeon is on backup in case something goes wrong, which is, it's a rarity, but you've got to have that backup there. So we're seeing a lot more interventional cardiologists coming out of medical school, and frankly, a lot fewer cardiac surgeons. Wouldn't you agree?
I totally agree. And you're not graduating your typical cardiovascular surgeon. Now they're specializing in either cardiac and thoracic, cardiac and vascular work. They're learning to control the wires and do minimally invasive vascular repairs. Esophagus work, lung work with the cancer surgeons. Finding a true CABG or bypass or a valve replacement, they're rare. They're really, really rare. To stay competent, you have to be able to do enough to make sure that your muscle memory is there. So I think that profession, that specialty is going to struggle as you go a little bit more towards thoracic work, esophageal work, vascular work, both open and invasive.
Yeah, we brought in a new cardiovascular or cardiothoracic surgeon in my last hospital about a year or so ago. And his work was defined in the box. Yeah, right here. You know, if it's heart, great. lung, great. Esophageal, great. I mean, back in the day, you would never see a cardiothoracic surgeon doing anything with like GERD or anything like that. And now that's something that they're doing. You know, I talked to back to the calcium score, you know, people go and do that typically to see what the calcification is in and around the heart. But really, the great thing about that is that it catches anything in the box, right? You know, because so yeah, you're going to see the calcification in the vessels, but we also identified lung nodules. We identified AAA, even breast cancers. And so we're seeing a lot more of the cardiothoracic surgeons really migrating away from the heart and really doing, you know, as you said, lung nodule. They're working very closely with the oncologist now, where, you know, 20, 25 years ago, that was a rarity. So, there's another aspect of cardiology or cardiovascular services that we've seen a huge pickup over the last 5 to 10 years, and that's electrophysiology or the EP docs. Talk a little bit about electrophysiology and you know, kind of educate my audience that may not be as familiar about that.
Yeah, electrophysiology, they're the electricians. They're the ones that go in, you know, the interventional cardiologists are the plumbers. The heart failure doctors are the pump doctors. So they're the ones that that actually go into the heart and identify when there's misfirings happening. There are causing murmurs that are causing, you know, your heart to stop or to race uncontrollably, have atrial fibrillation, which, if not treated, will evolve into heart failure. And as you and your listeners know, heart failure, there's very little, there's no way of getting back from heart failure unless you do a lot of treatments that will prolong your life and your quality of life, but you never cure heart failure. That's one of the other things that's being worked on is in genetics, right? How do we regenerate the heart? So that's a conversation for another day. So the electrophysiologists, they use a venous system and they get into your heart. Same thing, same catheters. They cross the septum, and they take little catheters and they measure the conductivity of different spots of the heart, and they create these huge complex maps, and they're able to identify where the misfiring happens. And in the older days, you would go in with one catheter and you would make a burn inside the heart to be able to break that connection. And you had to go one spot at a time to burn inside. The patient was in the general anesthesia. You were in the EP lab for 3-4 hours. And that's the only technology that existed. About 15 years ago, cryoablation, a balloon that actually will go in the heart, and for limited applications, it would just do a freeze, which was supposed to do the same thing, create the disconnection. That way, the cells are firing the wrong way, don't have to do it. And very, very, very hit or miss. I think that's a new developing specialty over the past 20 years. Patients sometimes get better, and then you were discharged with a lot of medications to keep their heart rhythm going. If they could not control the heart rhythm, then you can install a pacemaker, an ICD, a IV ICD, a lot of devices to help control your heart. And about a year and a half ago, I would say, a new technology that totally revolutionized EP came out, a pulse field ablation, PFA. And I asked one of my doctors, you know, what's the difference? And basically it describes it going from point by point ablation to dropping a bomb in the upper chamber of the heart and everything gets done. They can be in and out of there in 20 minutes. And it's proven to be very, very effective. You know, the 1-year results are great. More companies are releasing new equipment, different catheters that operate a little bit different to try and make this better. So that is one of the biggest areas of growth that we have seen. Things that we could not do before, we're doing right now. And as technology evolves, as devices become smarter, more effective, you're going to have less and less need for the people that have to open you up and fix you up. So that's a lot of paradigm shifts happening in cardiovascular. We'll be able to ablate renal nerves and control hypertension. There's a little device that gets implanted under your skin with a lead to your bare nerve receptors that can control hypertension as well with electrical signals rather than with ablating renal nerve. There's so much going on when it comes to devices to help support the heart when your heart is failing, with mechanical devices short of a heart transplant. And there's been total artificial hearts many tries, many times, and more and more of those devices are investigational, gathering data to see what the next step will be.
Yeah, another thing that we did in our EP lab, and I'd love for you to talk a little bit about it, is the Watchman. Talk about that, because I always had my little spiel, so I like to hear other people's spiels as well about what Watchman really does.
In the atrium, there's sometimes a little appendage that's open. And in that appendage, since you don't have a lot of good flow, it creates blood clots. And those blood clots, if they leave the heart and they go to the brain, you'll cause a stroke. And they're very, very serious stuff. So up to 5-6 years ago, I would say the only thing that you had were meds. They'll give you your medications. It'll thin your blood, and it reduces your opportunity for stroke. But for some people that had different jobs, physical jobs, they couldn't really be on that therapy, because as soon as a little slice, you don't stop bleeding, a little bump, and you get huge hematomas. So, and you had to go in to the lab on a regular basis. I don't know if it was monthly or biweekly, to make sure that you're diluted enough not to cause stroke. So I would say in 2015, 2016, this Watchman device came out, and it's a device that you go through a catheter across a septum, and you can actually put a little plug and seal that opening to stop blood from flowing in and reduce your risk of stroke. And after 3 months, you can be totally off of your medication, much better quality of life. So that's another thing that the cardiac surgeons were doing when they had opened a patient. Now they don't have to do that, or they won't do that anymore, because now there are different ways of doing it. And there are a couple of companies out there that offer this device. I mentioned the Watchman, that is a branded name. I shouldn't be doing that. But that's right. It's like corking an open bottle of wine. You're putting a cork in that appendage, and it's done in the EP lab. It's done with anesthesia. It's done with a doctor that does a TEE to make sure that we're guiding it correctly. You deploy it, and then you watch the patient for the next 3 months, and they can get off their medication and have a much more improve their quality of life. Absolutely.
Boy, okay. I got to admit, I like your cork in a bottle of wine example a lot better than mine. I used to tell people it's like putting a little Tupperware lid on top of it and sealing it off. So I'm stealing yours. I'm just going to give you credit for it. Hey, last thing, let's talk a little bit about how are AI solutions coming into cardiovascular care now?
A real good question. Remember that the generation of CT scanners that we talked about, there's going to be there's AI built into newer cath labs, newer EP labs, newer CT scanners right now that can actually virtually give you a roadmap or where you need to go to, how to get there, what device to deploy. So again, it's meant to be a suggestion for physicians instead of going in there and trying to estimate, trying to roughly measure and you know, make an educated guess as to what size stent needs to go in there, how long the stent needs to be, is it placed in the right place. It will do that for you because it's seeing the whole picture, and it's learned and it's been trained with hundreds of thousands of different studies to understand anatomy and how to navigate anatomy. So it's there. You know, we had that heart flow. You know, heart flow was they took a CT. You send the CT scans to the heart flow company that processed for you. It will come back and tell you exactly, okay, these are the areas of concern. This is what the blockage looks like. This looks okay. You don't need to touch it. That's basically AI technology that was making those maps and giving the feedback to those physicians. And it's just evolving much faster. It'll be real time now instead of having to wait for post-processing to happen, and then you get your result back.
Very good. Okay. Well, I think we've covered the gamut of cardiovascular care today, Jorge. Any final words that you'd like to impart upon my audience?
My comment here in healthcare today is, as we're making all these advances in new technology and new treatments, they never are less costly than the incumbent and the legacy items. There's always a large markup for these revolutionary new devices and new technologies. And, reimbursement doesn't keep up with it. You have to offer it because that's what we do. We provide care to the community we serve. But you see a lot of hospitals that are closing, or mega mergers that are happening to try and rely on economies of scale to be able to manage cost in a much more efficient way. And, you know, smaller health systems that cannot get to that magnitude either will not be able to offer these treatments, will go out of business and struggle. Or keep struggling. And I think that would be a disservice that we're making to the communities we serve. But again, that's another topic, healthcare economics. It's one of those things that keeps me up at night, but I know that we're doing the good work. I know that, Kevin, you did the good work when we worked together, and we'll continue to do that.
Well, I appreciate that, Jorge. Yeah, we had a lot of fun, didn't we?
We did.
So, with that, Jorge, thanks again for joining me today on I Don't Care. Greatly appreciate your insights into CV care. Well, that's it, folks. That's today's episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Thanks so much for joining me, and we will see you again next week. Take care.